You know, most Sunday mornings I'm grateful for small things, like getting where I'm going on time or not showing up with coffee in the middle of my neck. Whenever I'm here, I get to be grateful for the great things, which is the extraordinary music in this absolutely glorious sanctuary. So thank you for that. It is not often that I talk about Jesus in Unitarian Universalist congregations, although I happen to be a fan. Those of us who were raised in conservative traditions that emphasized an unattainable holiness alongside an oppressive level of control, frequently via shame or guilt, sometimes find it difficult to think again about the stories of Jesus separate from those early experiences of religion. The traditional story about Easter, celebrated last week, is that of a miraculous story of a man who was dead and was then alive. That's the way the story is generally told, the triumph of life over death. Surrounding that story, there are many ways to make meaning. But consistent with most of the myths of Western culture, the basic narrative is typically told as an individual story. An individual triumph over individual challenge. In Jesus' hero's journey, he went into Jerusalem, was betrayed by one of his own, abandoned by the rest of his own, left alone, and killed by evildoers. The story that is told of those days preceding the resurrection is typically told as a story of community abandonment and oppression. And then, certainly and starkly, as the triumph of the story as the individual who rose from the dead. It's a story, when told that way, that doesn't need much wrestling, a happy ending that then abruptly skips to the dawning of a new day as early Christians organized to start a religious sect that would become a religion. But I believe that we miss something in that skip. That the story continues to be about community right there in that intervening time, in that very moment. Because if the story was about the individual simply overcoming death, then Jesus could have risen in the story and gone zippity-doo-dah up into heaven. But that's not how it happened. Instead, this story is full of parallels of community showing up. The first community that showed up, which I think is incredibly significant, was the women who were mourning at the tomb, who bore witness to that empty tomb and turned around and raced to tell others that Jesus was alive. The women's response to noticing that Jesus was gone was to first bear witness to it, then to believe it, then to turn around and to move to where the people were and tell them about it. Even when those people did not believe them and said things that we've all heard, silly women, people don't rise up out of tombs. Jesus is dead, stop talking. But those women bore witness to both pain and triumph. They noticed what needed to be done, they turned, and they acted. They were at the tomb to mourn, and when mourning was no longer the appropriate course of action, they changed course. Jesus taught that the reign of God is among us. He preached a version of what we now refer to oftentimes as beloved community. The idea that when we create justice for the most marginalized, we create justice for all. That when we set ourselves not simply to welcome the stranger into our midst, but to be changed by that, that is where we begin to create beloved community. I don't believe that beloved community exists without resurrection. I don't mean the literal resurrection of an individual, but the death and rebirth of a community. A community of faith that re-examines its assumptions and its priorities and chooses the path least walked in order to locate and serve and give life to what Jesus called the least of these. The community of faith that strives to be beloved community is a community that hears good news and immediately changes course. Quoting your own Reverend Aaron Splaine, the central message of Jesus' life, that we are called to care for each other, especially those who have less than we do, even if we ourselves have little, those who are more vulnerable than we are. Jesus challenged an immoral, oppressive, and corrupt government. He upended social and cultural norms by acknowledging the inherent worth and dignity of those cast aside by others, the marginalized, the poor, those whose bodies were broken, anyone of any status, including women who had none. He built no walls, denied no one entry, denied no one their humanity. I want to suggest that it's not the resurrection of the individual that makes for liberation and justice. It is the movement and connection of that individual and a community who are both willing to change and be changed by that interaction. It is not inviting a newcomer to join a congregation or any other group that creates liberation. It's the act of community that follows that. The willingness of the community to be changed. The Spork story this morning, which I bet you didn't know was going to be part of the sermon. The Spork story this morning is on its face of it about an individual who cannot find a place. Spork was too pointy or too round. The cutlery did not know what to do with Spork. But Spork was in their midst, sorta, kinda, adjacent. And when the messy thing arrived, there was the ability in the community to support the messy thing, ultimately, to get his needs met, as well as Spork's need to serve and be served. But I like to think that the resurrection moment was the moment they noticed and recognized what they had previously missed. The moment when Spork came out of the side drawer and onto the table was not the end, but was the beginning of the story. Spork went on to swim with the others in the kitchen sink. Spork went on to take a prized place in the silverware drawer, not cast aside with other cutlery that was mismatched, but fully included, taking up space, requiring the cutlery drawer to be completely reorganized. Because when we do inclusion correctly, we find that we need to shift ourselves. The moment of resurrection is that moment of awareness, that moment of noticing, of bearing witness, and then is immediately followed by change. I am honored this afternoon to have been invited back to lead another workshop on preemptive radical inclusion and radical welcome. Today we're going to be looking at application and process and what do you do more than just the theory, but I want to tell you just for a minute what it is that I mean when I say that we create beloved community by the practice of preemptive radical inclusion. The idea of beloved community is another idea like the story earlier that I referenced some language from Christianity and people in the Christian tradition. It's how Jesus talked about it. It's how Reverend Howard Thurman or Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King talked about it, the idea that a just and equitable world is a world which might be called the reign of God, a world which can be created and bound by and defined as that which is the best. Not a world in a future heaven, and certainly not the warm, fuzzy feeling that we feel when someone welcomes us and is just nice for a moment. Not the feeling, but actual justice, actual equity. Preemptive radical inclusion, in big air quotes, means in its most simple form that when we are leaders, when we have responsibility, whether by rank or authority, or whether we have privilege or power in a particular space or place or moment, We have the responsibility to preemptively act as though everyone is already among us. We do not wait for someone to show up and tell us their needs. We think ahead of time. Spork is in the wrong drawer. What do we need to do to make space for Spork? This is how we change the world. Insofar as people's needs can be anticipated, we preemptively prepare for that welcome. Whether it has to do with equitable access to communication and space in our worship by ensuring that there are large print pieces of paper and hearing assistance devices and incredibly well-amplified services, or physical access points that will work for people with any mobility issues. And by mobility issues, I mean we all have mobility issues. You get that, right? We all have to move in the world. When we do these things, we preemptively welcome all. Those of us who are white work very hard to unlearn and counter the casual or intentional racism with which we were raised, to notice and name and dismantle the systems of white supremacy that undergird our culture and privilege us in ways that others might experience the same thing as marginalization or oppression. We notice and respond to the disproportionate advantage that we have been afforded in this culture. In the framework of preemptive radical inclusion, those of us who are cisgender work preemptively to learn and notice and oppose the systems in our culture that privilege cisgender people, even as those systems marginalize and oppress transgender people and gender nonconforming people. In the framework of preemptive radical inclusion, of creating the beloved community, we don't do this because someone says, I would like you to do this, or I need this. We do it because it is the right thing to do. Full stop. Because injustice must be countered. We do it preemptively because it is a right thing to stand ethically opposed to injustice in concrete ways that can be experienced by people who join us in our midst as evidence that we are serious about dismantling oppressive systems and that we want to be in community with them. If Spork had always been on the table, the messy thing would not have made so much of a mess. The pointy forks and the round-headed spoons would not have assumed that Spork was wrong or unnecessary, or said, hey, listen, Spork, you're welcome here in the kitchen, but this drawer over here is for the table cutlery. We know best what's needed on the table, and we know how to do it. Spork would simply have been understood to be part of who they were as a whole community of cutlery, regardless of any understanding that someone else had of Spork's call or Spork's gifts. Beloved community is not simply a community of inclusion. All are welcome is a true and important thing, and it is the beginning. It's not the goal. Inclusion is a method by which we create the space within which equity and justice can happen, by which we set up the possibility that there's a space in the silverware drawer for Spork before Spork even shows up. Jesus rose from the grave in that story as an individual, but it was the community that went on to make change. It was the community that first said that salvation and liberation was available to all. The Christian Apostle Paul, problematic as he was, wrote that in the salvation Jesus preached, there was no Jew or Greek, male or female, slave or free. Early Christianity was radically inclusive. Would be unrecognizable now. It was a radically inclusive community that was meant to create justice. In a social world where women did not have access to religious services or spaces, Jesus included women in his followers. And Paul made a point of saying that women should keep their heads covered in church. Not directly answering the pokey question he had been asked, should women be allowed in church? Rather, he said, he assumed that of course they would be in church, and then made a silly little rule about it. It was radically inclusive for the time. Whether a story is about Jesus and Paul and women or Spork in a messy thing, the call to us is the same. Bear witness to another's life. Believe them what they tell you. Notice our own assumptions and our own direction and change course appropriately. We make room in both the silverware drawer and at the table. This is how we love one another. Thank you.